Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Well, today we learned more details about the officers being investigated by Tennessee authorities in connection with the death of Tyre Nichols. We already knew that five now former officers were fired by the Memphis Police Department for being directly involved in what was being referred to at the time as the physical abuse of Tyre Nichols. But today we learned that an additional two were suspended by the department on the same day, including the officer whose body camera provided this footage that we're looking at of the initial traffic stop that ultimately resulted in the violent beating of Tyre Nichols. That officer, Preston Hemphill, was confirmed today as the sixth officer suspended for his involvement in the violent encounter. The department says he was being investigated in part for using a taser against Nichols during their interaction. A lawyer for Hemphill told the New York Times that Hemphill was never present at the second scene where officers caught up with Mr. Nichols after a brief foot chase and beat him severely, adding that his client, quote, is cooperating with officials in this investigation, end quote. Hemphill has not been charged with any crimes. The Memphis Fire Department today also fired three medical technicians that it says violated numerous policies and failed to conduct an adequate patient assessment of Tyre Nichols after officers called them to respond to a person who was pepper sprayed. Additionally, the head of the Shelby County Sheriff Department says two of its deputies who appeared on the scene after officers beat Nichols have been relieved of duty pending an investigation into their actions. Those deputies have yet to be identified. Today, the parents of Tyre Nichols accepted an invitation by Congressman Steve Horsford of Nevada, the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, to attend President Biden's State of the Union address next week. Congressman Horsford says he wants them to hear directly from both the president and lawmakers about efforts to implement police reform in the aftermath of their son's death. Now, that comes as both Democratic Senator Cory Booker and Republican Senator Tim Scott have expressed a renewed interest in passing federal police reform legislation after the two led negotiations on the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act last year. That act passed the House, never made it to the floor of the Senate because they couldn't get an agreement. The mother of Tyre Nichols said today she hopes her son's death leads to change.
I feel like my son was sacrificed for the greater good, and it's going to be a lot of good that comes out of this. Hopefully we can help another kid and another family not go through something like this. My son will always be remembered, and I will continue to fight until justice is served for him.
Now, the Shelby County District Attorney has so far only indicted the five officers who were terminated by the Memphis Police Department, all of whom have been charged with seven crimes, including second-degree murder. But additional indictments could be on the way. The district attorney released a statement today that read, quote, "The current charges do not preclude us from adding additional charges as more information is presented. We're looking at all individuals involved in the events leading up to, during, and after the beating of Tyre Nichols. This includes the officer present at the initial encounter who has not so far been charged. Memphis Fire Department personnel and persons who participated in preparing documentation of the incident afterward. The DA's office worked extraordinarily swiftly but thoroughly to charge those whose offenses were plain and clear and directly contributed to the death of Mr. Nichols. But in no way is this investigation over," end quote. The efficiency with which this investigation has moved could be credited first to the chief of the Memphis Police Department, who within days of viewing the footage of the police encounter, suspended, fired, and then referred the officers involved to the district attorney's office for prosecution. Chief C.J. Davis says recent calls for police reform led her to move quickly.
Words can be empty sometimes. That's why it was important for me not just to deliver condolences or apologies or I'm sorry. You know, what I wanted to deliver for this family at least was that first step of justice for them to quickly deal with these officers within the scope of my power and to help facilitate this movement to the DA's office as well. It was obvious to me that what I saw was beyond the scope of what is condoned in this police department and any department that I've ever worked in before.
The efficiency and severity with which the district attorney's office has begun indicting the officers involved in Tyre Nichols' death, particularly in a conservative state like Tennessee, could be credited to the Shelby County District Attorney Steve Mulroy. He was elected last year after campaigning on a progressive platform to tackle race and income-based inequalities within the criminal justice system. District Attorney Mulroy said this about the, quote, extraordinary speed with which the officers were charged.
These charges were brought extraordinarily quickly through a lot of hard work on the part of the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation and my own staff, including my newly created Justice Review Unit, which was designed to be independent and objective and looking back to see whether we had done wrongful convictions, but it's also useful in these kinds of officer-involved fatality cases. Less than 3 weeks from the actual incident itself, which is really unprecedented, but it was necessary in order to allow the video to be released after charges were brought so that there'd be transparency, but also we'd tamp down any potentially violent response.
Our next guest, Wendy Thomas, cited the speed with which District Attorney Steve Mulroy issued indictments as proof that elections matter. She wrote, "Anyone who knows Memphis can't think that charges would have come so quickly if Mulroy's Republican predecessor was still in office." Joining us now is Wendy C. Thomas. She is the editor and publisher of MLK50, Justice Through Journalism. It's a nonprofit newsroom that focuses on power, poverty, and public policy in Memphis. Also with us, Tennessee State Senator London Lamar. She represents the state's 33rd district, which includes parts of Memphis. And Mark Claxton, former NYC police detective and public relations director of the Black Law Enforcement Alliance. Thank you to all three of you for being with us this evening. Wendy, let me start with you, please. This idea that these first five officers were charged so quickly, a lot of people sort of saw the pictures of them first and said, well, they're black. That must be why they were charged so quickly. White police officers were not charged that quickly. But when you peel a couple of layers of the onion, your thesis is that this district attorney, in concert with a well-regarded police chief who has a strong sense of morality and responsibility, is more the reason why these charges came as swiftly as they did.
Oh, I wouldn't speak to the integrity or morality of the police chief. I think the video kind of spoke for itself, and she was probably forced to do what she was forced to do. I do think that the new district attorney, Steve Mulroy, ran on a campaign of being progressive and being transparent. I think that the grassroots organizers and activists have held his feet to the fire on that, and that he is committed to delivering. I don't think, as a lot of people have said, that the race of the officers has much to do with it. It's more the race of the victim and how black people are treated at the hands of police.
Senator London, let's talk about this. You heard the district attorney and others talking about the fact that they took into account the what they could do initially because they had this video, so they could lay charges against those who were clearly depicted in that video as contributing directly to the death, as they argue, of Tyre Nichols, and that they wanted to do things that would act in a way that would contain further violence that might come as a result of not charging these police officers. How do you think this has been handled so far?
In my opinion, I think that this case has been handled very efficiently. I think because of the progress we have made at progressing police policy that holds officers accountable, I think because of the state law that we passed in 2019 that requires officers to intervene when they see another officer using excessive force, is the reason these officers were held accountable, means that our system is working. And while there is much work to do, the reason that Tennessee has worked out so quickly on this particular issue is because we are doing what we need to do in order to hold police officers accountable. Ben Crump said himself, Memphis should be a blueprint for the rest of the nation and police departments across the country on policies that you need to implement to hold police officers accountable and how we were able to handle this particular incident so quickly. So I want to commend our DA Mulroy. I want to commend our police chief, and I want to commend our mayor for initially taking this case seriously and jumping straight into action.
Wendy, I heard hesitation in your voice about commending the police chief. You have some reservations about that.
The police chief put into place the Scorpion unit that was, we now know that the officers that were responsible for Tyre Nichols' death, she put that unit, that task force, that elite unit with very junior officers into place. We know that unit had been aggressive and violent towards other drivers before. And so I guess I would just pause before giving her too much credit, because the unit that's responsible, she created that. That was her baby. And until this happened, and even in the immediate days after the death, she was still, you know, crediting the Scorpion unit, saying it was a good thing, that they've been doing good work. So, yeah, I won't jump on that bandwagon yet.
Mark Claxton, what's going on in conversations either in Memphis or around the country with police? Because part of the reason the Justice and Policing Act didn't get passed is it really got hung up on this idea of accountability of police officers through the ability to bring civil suits against them. Well, that's one thing if cops think they've got skin in the game. But the other one is if they actually think they're going to get charged by a district attorney and that their own police chief is going to make public comments and probably comments in court about how they weren't following policy. Does this sort of thing have a material effect with police around the country?
Absolutely. The conversation around the issues involving the death of Mr. Nichols, the killing of Mr. Nichols, resonates throughout police agencies across the nation. So it is very relevant and important and on the forefront of conversation in different police circles. I think what police, especially Black police, and I should be more specific, Black police are waiting for a further deep dive and examination into some of the racial dynamic that is in play here. We can't ignore the fact that the victim is Black, which is sort of typical, but we have five offender police officers who are Black, at least five at this point, and a police chief who's Black. And at some point, we're going to have to kind of deep dive into some of the dynamics of race and its role and import in law enforcement, and specifically in this particular case. I think it would be very eye-opening and would point towards some of the larger issues with the toxic police culture that we've been trying to speak about.
Senator London, let me ask you about the report in the New York Times about the Scorpion Unit, in which it said the Scorpion Unit emerged as Memphis police pursued a get tough strategy. This is obviously important to politicians when people are complaining about crime. With five officers charged with murder, community leaders are now trying to assess how a unit that was supposed to ease the violence in Memphis had instead inflicted an attack so brutal that Chief Davis herself called it heinous and inhumane. The city announced the disbanding of the unit on Saturday, and Chief Davis has called for a review of all of her department's specialized units. Tell me how you weigh this as a legislator. People don't like crime. People call for cops to get tough on crime, but this is not what they thought they were asking for.
Absolutely. What I would say is it's no secret that Memphis has an issue when it comes to violent crime, is that Memphis has, unfortunately, some of the highest homicide rates in the country because of decades of disinvestment in our communities when it comes to education, when it comes to housing, when it comes to jobs, and all of the socioeconomic structures that help create a viable city. Now, because of our issues when it comes to violent crime, yes, the police department has to create specialized opportunities and initiatives to keep citizens safe. Citizens don't need more violent crime in our communities. Right now, we have a lot of juvenile crime going on. And so while we know the Scorpion unit had a lot of mistakes, what I would say is in efforts going forward to curb violent crime, we need more oversight. We need more rules around what all they can do. Unfortunately, this particular unit did not have enough oversight. Some of the officers who were involved in this particular unit shouldn't have been involved in it. But I won't say that the community doesn't want police to help continue attacking violent crime. What we want to do is put the right people in place to make sure that we can use initiatives and programs that are going to keep people safe and is not going to allow police officers to take the law into their own hand. Rules are made for a reason. While we put rules, policies, parameters in place, people end up breaking them, including some of our police officers. But on the flip side, because of these rules and parameters we put in place, we were able to hold these people accountable and quickly. So I hope going forward that we learn from this lesson as we create opportunities to keep people safe. We know what we need to do in order to hire the right people to do this job. But I want to continue to ask the community that we rebuild this trust and our police officers, because until we can reduce the violent crime in this community, we're going to have to figure out how we can heal and move forward.
Wendy, you know, obviously in the wake of George Floyd's death, we had some people in this country calling for the defunding of police. And some people meant that to be a reallocation of resources, and some people meant really defund the police. On the other hand, Mark and I were talking the other day to a former captain, a black woman who was a captain of the police in Maryland. And she said, police culture eats police training and policy for breakfast. Those are the words she used. She said, all the training in the world becomes very hard to overcome police culture, whether you're black or white.
I mean, I think that's fair. I think that whether you put black people or black officers or white officers in a system that devalues black life, you're going to get the same kind of outcome and the same kind of results. You know, I think some of what Senator Lamar says is absolutely right. Memphis, like most major cities in the country, has struggled with increases in homicide rate, although the homicide rate was down in 2022 when compared to 2020 and 2021. I think that in our rush, perhaps, to address crime, we failed to ask the right kind of questions about what kind of policing that we're getting, whether it's too harsh, whether it's too abusive, and whether there could be some resources better devoted to mental health, health care, again, investing in neighborhoods and communities. You know, the answer to everything cannot be more policing, but when all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail.
Thank you to all three of you. I appreciate this. This is an important conversation. We'll have it many times. Wendy C. Thomas is the Tennessee State. Wendy C. Thomas is the editor-in-chief of MLK 50, Justice Through Journalism. She's the editor and publisher of that. London Lamar is a Tennessee State Senator. Mark Claxton is a retired NYPD detective and the public relations director of the Black Law Enforcement Alliance. All right, coming up, some prominent Republicans are still engaging in election denialism, and election workers are still facing threats to their safety. Arizona's new Secretary of State, Adrian Fontes, joins us next.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
So many around the nation are now fulfilling their duties under the disgraceful and anti-American circumstances involving harassment and threats towards election officials, threats to their lives. This domestic terrorism is anathema to the constitutional order and must be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Honor and integrity will replace conspiracy and fascism.
Powerful words there from Adrian Fontes, who vowed to protect our democracy from dangerous election deniers when he was sworn in as Arizona's Secretary of State. After defeating one of Arizona's election denier candidates, Adrian Fontes forcefully attacked election denialism, calling threats against election officials and efforts to subvert the will of the voters a form of domestic terrorism. Many of those candidates were defeated in November, but those lies and the threats of violence stemming from those lies are still harming our democracy and forcing some dedicated election workers to quit. Let's take a look at Cochise County, Arizona, where an elections director who has repeatedly stood against Republican efforts to undermine elections is resigning, citing a physically and emotionally threatening work environment. Her departure is leaving many residents worried about the security of their elections, given who might replace her. One resident told VoteBeat, quote, "This is someone who is sanity in a storm of ridiculousness." But she's not the only one. VoteBeat reports, quote, "In the last few years in Arizona, longtime election directors in Pima, Yavapai, and Pinal counties, as well as recorders in Yavapai and Yuma counties, have stepped down." New audio obtained by the Washington Post between an election worker and a caller as votes were being counted in Maricopa County last year shows us just how disgusting these threats are. I warn you, this audio is disturbing.
Are you a Maricopa County resident, sir?
No.
I can file a complaint for you if you are.
I'm just disgusted by people like you. You're a joke.
I'm sorry, I do not tolerate that kind of language. If you would like to talk to me in a civilized...
These are the kinds of violent threats that these election lies can create. But to this day, the losing gubernatorial candidate, Carrie Lake, is still challenging the results of her election in November, which she lost by more than 17,000 votes. So is Donald Trump, who, in addition to repeating his false claims about the 2020 election at his own rallies this weekend, called in to Carrie Lake's rally, telling the crowd she will emerge victorious in her effort to overturn her election, even though her case has already been dismissed by a judge for lack of evidence. Donald Trump and his cohort of election deniers don't care who those lies are hurting, but Arizona Secretary of State does, and now he's sending a criminal referral to the Arizona Attorney General to investigate Carrie Lake for potential violations of state law for showing voter signatures in her tweets about unfounded election fraud. Joining us now is the Arizona Secretary of State, Adrian Fontes. Secretary Fontes, good to see you again. Thank you for being with us. I want to just create some context around this for our viewers. You and I spoke on October 29th in Phoenix, and I had spoken to a number of Phoenix voters, Republicans, who were actively supporting you in the election because they felt that Republican election deniers were undermining Arizona's conservative and Republican heritage. They openly backed you against a Republican candidate whom you defeated because they felt that Republicans were undermining themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. First, thank you for having me, Ali. It's good to see you again. We spoke in October, we won in November, and the fight continues. You mentioned some of the counties that have had some of these losses earlier. Let me update your list really quickly. We've lost election directors in Yuma County, Cochise, Pima, Yavapai, Pinal County twice, wow. Santa Cruz County, and county recorders and elected registrar of voters in Pinal, Yavapai, Yuma, and Santa Cruz. We only have 15 counties in Arizona, Ali.
These are not people who we ever talked about on the news. People don't know their names. They don't know who they are. They are the bones of government, if you will, the bones of elections that you don't see or hear about. And they're leaving
here. And you know what, Ali? I know their names. Yeah. I worked with them when I was the Maricopa County recorder. These are good, decent, honorable Americans. They are Republicans and Democrats and independents. There are folks who just want to get the job done so that our democracy, the democracy that serves this republic, can perpetuate this republic. And these new American fascists, the MAGA fascists, you call them denialists, they are fascists. We need to call them who they are. They're acting in these ways. And these threats, these live threats at the drop boxes with rifles, all this stuff, the result is what they want. They want chaos. They want disorder. And that's why we had so many level-headed Republicans, particularly from the business community, supporting my campaign. And we're not going to tolerate this nonsense under any circumstances. And this is one of the reasons why we made the referral that we made.
You were saying that you know their names. And I was going to tell you, I didn't even know most Secretary of States in this country's names a few years ago. It was not routine for us in the media to generally interview them unless it was around an election and probably just to tell you how elections worked. And yet now secretaries of state across this country have become the defenders on the front line of our democracy. It's a strange world that we're in, but you are talking a language that we're not used to hearing. You are going after
these.
Well,
we better get used to it. Yeah, we've got to get used to it, Ali, and we've got to stop pretending like their feelings matter. These are people who are threatening the lives of our neighbors, our family members, and they're threatening the health of our democracy. And the more we are mealy-mouthed about this, the more space they get. We have to attack this terrorism directly because it is an attack on our democracy. January 6th was just a start, and it's bigger than just this. But at the end of the day, these clerks across the country, your treasurers, your auditors, your recorders, your election folks, They need us to step up. They need all of us, not just secretaries of state. They need all of us to step up to stop this nonsense, because our democracy is fragile. It needs protecting, and it really needs cooler heads to prevail. But the cooler heads cannot come just by sitting on the sidelines and saying, oh, gosh, this will go away. It's not going away. Well, in fact, in some cases, it's getting worse.
I was going to ask you this, because your state is on the front line of this thing. And with the victory of your attorney general in your state, people sort of thought that sort of across the country in battleground states, the people who stood for democracy won across the country. But in fact, the truth is, as you say, this is still there. Your gubernatorial candidate who lost will not concede her election. Donald Trump is still carrying on about this. And lots of Republicans say they're over it. But it is still central to what Republicans are doing state after state in this country.
Well, and look, it's not the GOP Republicans. Let's be very, very clear. These are the MAGA fascists. There are two parts of that party anymore. And registered Republicans don't fall in one camp. There are the regular GOP Republicans who just want us to get back to normal. They want to run their businesses and live their lives and pray and have their families and do all that good stuff. Good. But those MAGA fascists, they want to take all of the books off the shelves. They want to test our power grids by knocking out power stations across the country. This is a real threat here, folks. And I'm not just the canary in the coal mine. We've been seeing it develop year in and year out for the last couple of years. And those of us on the front lines who are seeing these folks leave these offices, work that they love, and moreover, their expertise is going with them. Their experience is going with them. And so it's going to fall to us at the state to help these counties actually run their elections. And so we're going to need the resources necessary quickly, because guess what? We're almost just a year away from the voter registration deadline for the 2024 presidential preference election right here in Arizona, which is next March. 2024 is on top of you if you're an election administrator in Arizona. We need that help, and we need to end this nonsense. But we need to do it with vigor and strength, because I think that's the only language that these terrorists are going to pay attention to.
Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fuentes, thanks for taking time for us tonight. Thanks for the work that you're doing in Arizona.
Happy to be here, Ellie.
All right. When we come back, how do Republicans think they're going to solve their Donald Trump problem before that 2024 election? You're not going to believe what some of them are hoping for. McKay Coppins, staff writer for The Atlantic, tells us about it when we come back.
Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed at home in your Keurig coffee maker with Dunkin' cold K-Cup pods. Just brew it hot over ice and enjoy flavor that's crafted to serve cold. The home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
How do you solve a problem like the Donald? That seems to be the question on a growing number of Republican minds. But for those with MAGA fatigue, there doesn't seem to be a clear-cut answer. This is the focus of an insightful and sardonic new piece for The Atlantic by McKay Coppins. He'll join us in a moment. It's headlined, Republicans 2024 Magical Thinking. According to the piece, some in the party are waiting for the long arm of the law to take Trump down, and they can now add to the long list of Trump's legal troubles this. Two sources familiar with the situation confirmed to NBC News that a grand jury has been convened in the case of hush money payments made to Stormy Daniels by Donald Trump in 2016. A spokeswoman for Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg declined comment. That was first reported today by the New York Times. But this legal downfall strategy is definitely not foolproof. McKay writes, Trump's detractors dream of an indictment that would derail his campaign, but most of the people I talked with seemed resigned to the likelihood that an indictment would only boost him with the party's base. Another option, quote, others imagine a coordinated donor revolt that sidelines Trump for good, end quote. But still others are hoping for a more enduring solution to the Trump problem. Peter Meyer, a Republican who spent just one term in Congress and voted to impeach Trump, told McKay this, quote, I've heard from a lot of people who will go on stage and put on the red hat and then give me a call the next day and say, I can't wait until this guy dies, end quote. Meyer also said, I want to be clear, I'm not in that camp. McKay explains their rationale was straightforward. The former president is 76 years old. He's overweight. He appears to maintain the diet of a college freshman and believes, contrary to all known science, that exercise is bad for you. Why risk alienating his supporters when nature will take its course sooner or later? Joining us now is McKay Compton, staff writer for The Atlantic. I don't know how you kept a straight face while you were writing this thing, McKay, but in all of the humor is a stark reality. There's no obvious way for Republicans who think that Donald Trump is actually detrimental to the party to deal with him.
That's right. I think that all those scenarios that I wrote about really speak to the desperation within the party and, frankly, the degree of cravenness that we see on display, right? For the last 7 years, there has been this long-running discussion among party elites that Trump is bad, but there's nothing we can do about it. There's this kind of helplessness that has ingrained itself in the Republican psyche. And the Republican officials and party strategists I talked to basically said, nobody wants to be the first one to jump. Nobody wants to take on Trump directly because we've seen what he does with his rivals. And so we would rather just have this problem resolved for us without us needing to do too much. And that was kind of the running theme throughout all my conversation.
So you had a quote from a conversation with Rob Portman, the former senator from Ohio. And he said, when I asked Rob Portman about his party's Trump problem, the recently retired Ohio senator confidently predicted that it would all sort itself out soon. The former president, he believed, would study the polling data, realize that other Republicans had a better shot of winning, and graciously bow out of 2024 contention. I let out an involuntary laugh. Quote, maybe that's wishful thinking on my part, Portman conceded. I mean, it's not how Donald Trump rolls. And according to other parts of your article, it's not what the polls indicate at the moment. Now, things can change a lot between now and the election, but Donald Trump is beating out his closest rivals by double digits.
Right. I think that the conventional wisdom within the political class in general, and especially within the Republican Party, is Trump is weak. He's fallen in his popularity has declined. He's falling in the polls. This issue will take care of itself. I think that the conventional wisdom dramatically overstates his weakness. He is leading his nearest rival by 15 points at least. He still remains by far the most popular figure in the Republican Party among rank and file voters. And he has shown no desire or willingness to back off. In fact, as recently as last month, he was threatening on his social platform, Truth Social, to run a third party bid if he doesn't win the Republican nomination. And so this is very clearly an issue for the party. And to me, the obvious takeaway is that there's no way to get rid of Donald Trump without a Republican taking him on directly. And I think that this kind of deus ex machina dream of, you know, the fate sorting this all out is a little bit delusional.
McKay, it's a great read, and I hope people watching us tonight read it. Thanks for joining us, McKay Coppins. All right, today, President Biden's Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, visited Jerusalem for some old-school shuttle diplomacy as a series of crises unfold in the Middle East. We'll bring you up to speed next. Tonight, the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is in Jerusalem on a high-stakes trip as multiple crises are unfolding at the same time in the Middle East. On Saturday, Israel carried out a drone attack on an Iranian military facility in the city of Isfahan, which is home to approximately 2 million people. That's according to senior intelligence officials who spoke to my next guest. In a statement shared with the Islamic Republic News Agency, Iran's foreign ministry said that three quadcopter-style drones were downed by defense systems at the military facility. This comes, coincidentally or not, as violence is flaring once again between Israel and the Palestinians. Over 30 Palestinians have been killed since the start of the year, including at least 9 during a raid by Israeli military forces in Jenin on Thursday last week. It was the single deadliest Israeli military operation in decades and led to Palestinian authorities partially ending a shaky security agreement with Israel. On Friday, 7 people were killed by a Palestinian gunman outside of a synagogue in an East Jerusalem settlement. On Saturday, 2 more Israelis were shot and wounded by a 13-year-old Palestinian boy. After meeting with newly elected Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today, Secretary of State Blinken condemned the violence and emphasized the need for a two-state solution.
That's why we're urging all sides now to take urgent steps to restore calm, to de-escalate. We want to make sure that there's an environment in which we can, I hope, at some point create the conditions where we can start to restore a sense of security for Israelis and Palestinians alike, which, of course, is sorely lacking.
Now, to be clear, Secretary of State Blinken's visit to the Middle East isn't going to solve any of these problems by itself, but it's a visible sign to the region that America's trying to take its seat at the table back for the first time in a long time. The internal politics inside Israel have changed since the last time Netanyahu was in office, and that could change the politics for Israel's indispensable ally, the United States. In order to regain power, Netanyahu had to embrace Israel's hardline conservatives even more than the great bear hug he gave them the last time he was prime minister. Here's how Thomas Friedman described the situation in the New York Times. Quote, an ultra-nationalist, ultra-orthodox government formed after the Netanyahu camp won election by the tiniest sliver of votes, roughly 30,000 out of some 4.7 million, is driving a power grab that the other half of voters view not only as corrupt, but as also threatening their own civil rights, end quote. Secretary Blinken may have alluded to Israel's domestic political situation during his remarks today.
Our fellow democracies can also make us stronger. That's what the United States and Israel have done for each other over many decades, by holding ourselves to the mutual standards we've established, and by speaking frankly and respectfully, as friends do, when we agree and when we do not. The discussion that the Prime Minister and I had today was no exception.
Joining us now is Ronan Bergman. He's a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. He's the author of Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. Ronan, thank you for joining us. I know there's a bit of a delay because of the internet connection that we have right now, so we'll be patient with that. I do want to ask you to put into context what's going on here. We have this remarkably rapidly escalating situation between Israel and the Palestinians, and then we have this situation in Iran. Netanyahu has been singularly focused on Iran in the last several years when he has been the prime minister. Iran is finding itself on the wrong side of a lot of equations these days with the protests at home and the fact that it's partnering with Russia in its war in Ukraine. Give me your context of what is happening right now.
Hi, Ali, thank you for inviting me again. I would say high tech and low tech. And in a way, the U.S. Is trying to find its way with this new government and the new situation. In Iran, Israel just demonstrated its remarkable intelligence capabilities and operational capabilities to know where Iran is producing those missiles. By the way, in the middle of, as you said, a big city, 2 million people, and sending drones with limited quadropter, with limited range, which means for the Iranians, another cause of concern, those were deployed, was launched by a team from Iranian territory. Mossad has a capability to deploy and launch suicide drones inside Iran. So that is Israel, as maybe Israel would like to see itself, long range, far beyond enemy territory, risky and daring operations, and trying to destroy sophisticated R&D and production missile of Iran. Now this, on the background of Israel and the United States, basically see things exactly the same way regarding Iran. Now, Iran is aligning with the Russians. No major gaps in intelligence between Israel and the U.S. about the Iranian nuclear advancement. So more or less seeing the same. And Israel is capable of doing all those things while the chief of the CIA visiting Israel last week, the Secretary of State, as we just saw, is visiting Israel this week, and Israel is not doesn't have any problem signaling the Iranians, look, we are in cahoot, we are in cooperation, we are in coordination with the United States. Even though we have those senior Americans, we still go and does that. My colleagues, Farnas Fasihi and David Singer at the New York Times and myself, we report about the ongoing campaign that Prime Minister Bennett and then Prime Minister Lapid, now taken by Prime Minister Netanyahu, is doing against Iran. Now, all of that, the all complete opposite is happening inside Israel. Low-tech terrorism, gunmen attacking Israelis. Israelis have, with remarkable intelligence capabilities, are sending troops inside Palestinian cities, killing terrorists, but at the same time killing civilians. this just put more oil on the flame and resulting in a circle of more and more violence, with this government promising a citizen, the ultra-right government promising a citizen that it will bring quiet to the streets of Israel, but at least for now reaching the exact opposite. And the American government, while aligning with Israel on Iran, is trying to signal Israel that on the domestic side and on the Palestinian issue, it is doing, I think, quite the opposite of what the U.S. government would like Israel to do. And we saw that first quietly in close conversations between American officials and Israeli leaders. But yesterday, I think quite clearly, openly, overtly, Secretary of State is trying to say to Israel, two-state solution, which is the exact opposite of most of what the Netanyahu government would like to do, and look at the issue of democracy and human rights inside Israel. Those remarks were heard, I think, were never heard from an American official about Israel. And this is something that the Israeli leaders, I'm sure,
You're saying, Ronan, that the Netanyahu government not so big on the idea of a two-state solution. Increasingly, Palestinians are not interested in a two-state solution either. At some point, you and I have talked about this in the past, the settlement of the matter with Palestine has dropped in terms of the agenda of the average Israeli. What happens now? Netanyahu succeeds in getting everybody's eye off that ball.
Well, let me just remind ourselves something that happened in Israel. In 1990, the Likud government, so the same party Netanyahu comes from, had massive majority among Israelis. But then the Intifada, series of riots and demonstrations started, and it showed the Israelis that the way of continue to control the territories would just lead to more riots and more violence. And just 2 years afterwards, because of the uprising, because of the Intifada, because of the protests, because of the demonstration, the Likud lost and the left-wing government tried to lead to a peace agreement. So I think the only, we spoke about this, Ali, and the Palestinian issue will completely shut aside. It will come again, because the Israelis wouldn't be able to ignore anymore the violence, the protests, and unfortunately, the terrorist attacks.
Ronan, thanks for joining us tonight. I know it's the middle of the night for you in Israel. We always appreciate your analysis. Ronan Bergman, staff writer for The New York Times Magazine, the author of Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. We'll be right back. And that's tonight's last word. Thank you for watching.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.